This is the Florida Spectacular Podcast, celebrating the Sunshine State. Here are your hosts, Kathy Celestri and John Kyle. Find Kathy on Twitter and Instagram at Kathy Celestri and online at GreatFloridaRoadTrip.com. Find John on Instagram at Don't Make Me Turn This Van Around and online at DontMakeMeTurnThisVanAround.com. Now, discover a Florida you never knew existed.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Florida Spectacular, your podcast about all the best parts of Florida. I'm Kathy Celestri, co-hosting with John Kyle, and today we talk about a little northeasterly part of the state.
Indeed.
Profound stuff.
Do you want to reveal what it is?
Oh, yeah, I guess they'd want to know. Yeah. Can't we just talk about it and let everybody guess?
That would be good. We could do trivia. Like, we're going to do a whole show where we don't tell anybody what we're talking about and then have them guess. We are going to talk about Amelia Island and Fernandina Beach, which is the town on Amelia Island. I don't know about you, but when I mention Amelia Island to people, and we go there fairly often because my wife has family there, we say Amelia Island, Fernandina Beach, and they give us this look like, what? They don't know where it is. And people who live in Florida, I'm not going to call them all Floridians, but people who live in Florida don't necessarily know about this area. Maybe it's because we're down on the Gulf Coast and people are very Gulf Coast centric down here. What's your experience with people's knowledge of the area?
Well, I don't know, because I talk about Fernandina when I say that. And anytime I talk about the area,
you say
I talk
Fernandina about, funny, first of all, because you keep saying Fernandina.
Fernandina.
Fernandina. Yeah.
Words lost all meaning.
Yes.
I think about it. I know that it's on Amelia. I do that. But when I think about it and talk about it, I'm typically talking about it in terms of history. You have to remember that when I'm talking about places, a lot of times I'm lecturing, not talking. I talk to you differently because you travel around Florida too, but I'm usually lecturing. Yeah. And so I'm talking about the history of, how am I supposed to say it?
It's Fernandina. So there's not Fernandina. Like, I mean, we'd say Fernando if it was a person's name, but as the locals, I think, would say it's Fernandina. You know, it's like, it just, you know, not quite so much emphasis in the middle of the word there.
So I talk about its history and how many flags it's had and the Spanish and, dates to the 16th century and, Jean Rabaut, and just I go into all that. So I think either people are really interested in that or their eyes just glass over anyway when I'm talking. So
if we start with the basics, Fernandina, Amelia Island is just north of Jacksonville, right before you get to Georgia, right?
Right. It's
part of the Sea Islands. It's got a very low country, South Carolina, Charleston, Jekyll Island, Georgia feel to it. It's, which is refreshing if you're used to the other areas of Florida, because it does have kind of a southern beach feel. When people go, where is that again? If you say Amelia Island Plantation, sometimes that'll jog some memories, because Amelia Island Plantation is this big, huge resort that has been there for a long time. And it was kind of designed in like an older resort style, like a kind of strung out under the oak trees along the behind the dunes. So it's kind of an interesting place, because it does not exude Florida resort style as much as it does sort of a southern resort beach style. I think it's interesting for that reason.
It's I love the southern vibe. You know, if some people in Florida are familiar with the saying, you have to go north to get south, because down here where we are in the Gulf, central Gulf Coast, it's New South, like, meaning that it was predominantly settled after the end of the Civil War. But Gainesville and Points North are Old South. They were predominantly settled before the Civil War. So there is a difference. what I love so much about the islands, especially as you're going right up into Georgia and South Carolina, that whole chain of islands just is such a beautiful Southern island feel, which is different than a Florida beach vacation. Woohoo! Why don't we get drunk and screw and listen to the Jimmy Buffett cover band vibe?
Right.
You know, it's just different. And I like that we can have such a different beach. And I love going there. I had a great experience there when I was there in September. We were camping at Fort Clinch, and it was just like this completely magical experience. We got to see a submarine surface. I got to see a very, very small gopher tortoise in the wild. I mean, like smaller than my hand. You know, just all the wildlife, the deer, yeah. The sun. It's just gorgeous. It's just such a beautiful, magical place. Don't care for the mainland. Very crowded. Maybe it was the time of year we were there, which shouldn't have been, but the coastal
mainland
areas.
Like,
how, like,
you mean like over the bridge in Yulee? I mean, or are you talking about like Fernandina Beach, the city, the town?
The city, okay. Fernandina Beach.
Because that's Yulee, the mainland, still on the island. Fort Clinch is in Fernandina Beach. I mean, it's, you drive out, you know, towards the beach, and it's, you know, it's tucked behind neighborhoods. Yeah.
Yes, it is. But I like the coastal neighborhoods there. I was impressed the first time, yeah. I went there, of how the neighborhoods were basically built right up to the sand dunes almost in some places, which I'm sure is an environmental disaster. But
it is definitely interesting the way the you know, you have that skinny strand of land between the road and the beach, where they have these huge dunes, like quite tall, with houses built in them, and usually room for one house, you know. And you know, and if you know Florida beaches and how they behave during major storms, you know how quickly there can be no room for a house there. But it is kind of in that little, I don't know if you've ever, like, you know, obviously we've all tracked hurricanes as they come through, but the way the coastline curves in at Jacksonville there, it makes it very difficult for because the hurricanes, oof, tend to come from the south. I'm saying,
be careful, man. Don't jinx anybody.
I know. I'll stop right there. But typically hurricanes tend to go up, you know, and then I make perpendicular landfall with Georgia and South Carolina because of the way they angle towards the south. That is not to say that Jacksonville and Fernandina have not, and St. Augustine, have had some terrible, terrible storm damage and flooding over the past few years. So they're not like immune from it, but it does explain why you do still see some beach shacks that haven't fallen into the sea along there. I want to say that, you know, the plantation goes back probably like 40 or 50 years or whatever. So it's kind of got this old feel. There's obviously been lots of new things built at the plantation, but there's also relatively within the last 15 years, I would say, a Ritz-Carlton is down there towards the plantation. And they hold a Concours d'Elegance, which is like this super duper fancy car show. And, like, you know, all these billionaires and millionaires fly in, and they have Rolls Royces and Bentleys and every Ferrari and everything. And so it's a very, like, as we sit and talk about the southern charm of Fernandina and Amelia Island, there's an influx of visiting money there that is startling. That you don't expect. It is not Panama City, South Beach type of a southern beach. No, it is I don't want to say northern money, or I just want to say, like, there's some very rich people that like to spend some time there. And their season does not track really with what we think of beach season in Florida. It can be a spring break destination, but it's far enough north that it does get very cold there. So it's not like a winter beach destination, although Christmas is very cool there. They do a great job with Christmas, and it's a neat place to visit during Christmas. It's cold. So really the summer is a time to visit there as well.
Florida cold.
Florida cold. Right.
It's Florida cold.
Yeah.
So it does.
I mean, unless you're Canadian, you're not getting in the water.
Well, a lot of Canadians. But yeah,
a lot of Canadians. It does, someone's got to swim in January.
It does track a little bit with how the Golden Isles, like Hilton Head and yes. Cumberland, it tracks with their season more than yes, our season.
Absolutely.
So, and it's interesting. Which is
their season? Because every time I go there, I'm cold. Right.
You know, Blair's parents used to live in Hilton Head, and I loved it. They were right on the beach, and it was really nice. But it is weird because their seasons are a little flip flopped. Yeah. Because I feel like at Christmas it was not very crowded, but in the summer when it was very warm, very very crowded. But I opposite of Florida, right? We September is the universal empty month, but Christmas time, it's usually pretty crowded, especially January, yeah, things like that.
I would say you could go there September, October and get perfect weather, you know? And whereas maybe down south, it's still a little too hot, like in Fort Lauderdale and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, we go to Jekyll Island. We've been there a couple times. We were there in January and it's cold. It's a cold beach. You're not like out there sunbathing or anything. But it is neat to visit these places when it isn't beach weather, because they do have a little bit more to offer than just the beach. There's history, there's dining.
Yes.
So
are you familiar with the War of Jenkins' Ear?
No, but I think you can tell me.
I'm not going to give you the whole history lesson, but I'm glad that you mentioned history because we stayed at the King and Prince Resort, which is not in Florida, but it is in the Golden Isles. But it's right there. It's part of the Golden Isles. And there's a national memorial there that I cannot remember the name of. But you get into this really bizarre war that we had. It was Spanish, I think, Spanish and British, probably. And it's one of those, there's maybe Spanish and Britain and Spain, and it was in the 18th century. And basically the reason they call it that is supposedly one of the British sailors lost an ear off the coast of Florida with you know, the Spanish cut off his ear, and the story goes that the ear made it back to the crown, and this started a whole war. They were so incensed that the sailor had lost an ear. Now the reality of the ear actually getting back from the coast of Florida, right at the Florida-Georgia border to Great Britain is, I'm going to call bullshit on that a little bit, but that was what we said. So it was basically piracy, even though we don't like to call it that. British ships kept Spanish ships fighting the whole thing. And anyway, this started a war, and, you know, King George was very upset. He was always off about something. And basically, it was for the battle. It was a battle for the border, essentially. And if things had gone differently, I always tell people Florida would be having British food all over the place instead of black beans and rice and Cuban, you know, this wonderful Spanish influx that we've had.
Interesting.
Yes. Well, it was a very important, that border was a very important. That's why Fort Clinch was built there. That border was significant well before Florida was part of the United States. I mean, we forget that Florida was like this little ping pong ball where, you know, we're British, we're Spanish, we're British, we're Spanish. And, you know, it all comes down to sugar and, you know, to grow the sugar to make the rum, and we need the slaves, and everybody's trying to hold on to the Caribbean, and Florida was the biggest part of that. And Fort Clinch was actually built, it was used, I think, in the Civil War. That was not its initial intent. So,
yeah, no, you know, I did a little research. I think it was like 1840s when Fort Clinch was the building, the structure that we know now, though it was a key spot before that. I think, you know, the interesting thing about, you know, that area also is, like, you know, like many outposts in the Civil War in Florida, like Key West, Fernandina fairly quickly became a Union, you know, the Confederates couldn't hold it. They weren't going to devote the resources to hold it. So the town sort of was in this middling, like, we're in the South, but we're not being controlled by Confederate forces. And then, so like when the Emancipation Proclamation was read, there were free blacks in Fernandina who celebrated the Emancipation Proclamation. And General Shaw's black regiment that we know from the movie Glory was there for a spell as well. And I've been spending a lot of time with General Shaw because he fought at Olustee, and my family, we visited Olustee. We were just in Boston where there's a big memorial to General Shaw, and he's got a tie to Fernandina Beach. So when we think of these, you know, we think of Florida as being all new, all post air conditioning. But if you go to Fernandina, you're going to get an old town that looks like someone dropped Savannah on the beach, you know, in a way, like old Savannah, not like new high rise Savannah. It's like it's got the main street. It's got the ice cream shop and, you know, it's got the Lilly Pulitzer and all. It's got all the resort wear shopping, you know, and the boat people clothing and everything. But it's got great food and it has real history. The museum there is very cool. We took our kids there back a few years ago, and I remember not only was it a cool, cool like local history museum, but
are you talking about the Amelia Island Museum of History?
Yes, yes. They've got all kinds of stuff on pirates and stuff there, but they also have like, you know, I'm one of these people that actually likes it when they throw up an exhibit with a whole bunch of words where you just read the history of the area. And it wasn't like it was crowded or anything. So I don't mind like getting that. But also they did a good job with like just a lot of artifacts and everything. Really funny story is our they had like some kind of a thing where they had a sound effect with some pirates singing music or something. I can't remember exactly what it was. But our kids realized that it was an Alexa back there playing this thing.
Really?
And so they started talking to this Alexa. They're making it do things that are, you know, I mean, they just had it like playing other music. It was random. Like I was like, hi. And they were, this was when they were like, you know, this is like several years ago. So they're pretty small at the time. I was like, good for you for figuring that one out. So note to the museum, don't let the, you know, delinquents mess with your Alexa sound effects.
Your kids are not delinquents.
Yeah.
I mean, no, it's a little stretch calling your kids delinquents. But my kids do know how to hack a
museum. That's
well, if
that's
the museum
their,
is silly
this is
enough
their
to use
ground,
an Alexa, right? I mean.
Yeah, they're all, so they're not beyond figuring out the inner workings. But yeah, I would definitely visit that. Talk about Fort Clinch, though, because you're like, you love, I mean, I love Fort Clinch, but you love Fort Clinch.
Picture this. You're sitting in a dimly lit room, headphones on, lost in the words of a stranger. Your feelings become exposed, and suddenly, you are not alone. Are you ready to feel deeply? Welcome to Thoughtful in the Dark, where emotions come alive through poetry, stories, and personal experiences. Join us. Subscribe now and let emotions guide you through episodes in both English and Spanish content. Because sometimes, the most profound moments happen when the world sleeps.
So I'm fascinated about everything with Fort Clinch. So you mentioned they started construction on the fort in the 1840s. Actually, the first fortifications started in the 1700s. But it was almost, I think, you can go to the State Park website and it'll tell you, you know, they started fortifying it in the 1700s, which was part of the we're Spanish, we're British type of nonsense. But then they started building the fort.
I think there
were
some French too in the mix there, weren't there? No.
They tried. They tried. I mean, they didn't do so well, but they did try. Yes, there were some French, but they never really got a stronghold. Like the Spanish were pretty serious about holding on to couple centuries.
The French weren't trying to change anybody's religion. That was the problem. They weren't.
No, they were escaping persecution, yeah. I believe. But yeah. I mean, it was they just weren't.
They just wanted to make
the
money.
Weather.
Yeah, right.
Well, I mean, they weren't paying attention to the weather. I mean, there was a hurricane coming, and the story goes they didn't, you know, really know, I guess, what that was, and they just ran into some problems, and the Spanish used it to their advantage. And it, anyway, so the fort itself started taking shape in the 1800s, even though Fort Clinch was, the area was fortified in the early to mid 18th century. But by the 20s, Basically, that's it. It was demolition by neglect. And was sold, it belonged to the Army then, because they figured, well, we're not going to need this as a fort anymore. You know, this is all the United States now. We won't ever need it. So basically, it just started to fall apart. And then during the Depression, when we had the Works Progress Administration, the Civilian Conservation Corps, which were the men, they were like 25-year-old men, and they were young, strapping men. They used to call them Roosevelt's tree army because they would do things like go plant trees, and they were put to work. They were paid, I think, $30 a week or a month or something, and most of it had to go home to their parents. But they did work on our first 9 parks and Fort Clinch. They worked on Fort Clinch. And what's really amazing to me about it is that it was Company 1420, and they were at Fort Clinch. And one of the jobs they had to do is that because the fort's right on the water and storms, I know there's no hurricanes. You've made that clear, John.
No,
I regret saying that. Over the years, there've been a lot of like crap, sand and dirt and other stuff. And so these 25-year-old boys actually used wheelbarrows to carry out tons of dirt and clear it out. And they basically, you know, restored the entire place. And so it was just a really incredible, it was backbreaking work. That to me in and of itself is that, you know, it's this piece of history I think people do not think about. I don't know how many people go to Amelia for the shrimp festival and don't go to Fort Clinch, but it really has some pretty good history. When we were there in September, we went into the fort and we're walking around, and there was a guy dressed like a soldier, a period soldier. And I wanted to ask him questions, but I don't like, have you ever go and you have the reenactors who pretend that it's still 1860 and they're like, right. What is that device in your hand?
What are these strange clothes you have?
Yeah, I don't want to do that. I please don't make me pretend that you actually lived when dysentery was a thing. Okay, I don't want to do it. So I was really hesitant. Finally went up to him and he wasn't like that at all. Was not like that at all. Super happy to talk to us. And I started talking about the WPA and the CCC. And he was really cool. And he said, because I mentioned that we had been at Myakka, which was another state park. And that was the state park because the Depression, we still had segregation in Florida. All the Black CCC workers had to go to Myakka. And that was the only known Black group of CCC workers. And so I'm talking to this guy and he says, well, let me show you something. And the next thing I know, he's taking me into this part of the fort. Yeah, you know, Barry's with me. I don't normally just go off with strange men dressed as soldiers. but he takes me to a part of the fort that is locked, former barracks or whatever. And he takes me into this back part. I mean, the public does not get to go there. And he shows me, he goes, now look, he says, this is where the WPA workers, you know, the CCC workers, like signed their names on the wall when they were in here. And he says, and there's another troop number here. And so he was talking to me how he suspected it was possible that that there were actually a second group of Black workers who actually worked in the area that were never documented. Huh. But it was just this whole fact. I'm like, I can't believe we happened on this guy. And he takes me back. It's something most people never get to see. Yeah. And it turned out he was an author about Fernandina history, about Amelia Island. And he's the historian for the park. And he was just really happy to talk. I can't promise you that you're going to get like a VIP tour of the fort if you go there. But I will say again that, you know, our state park rangers are just incredible. Yeah. I mean, he was so happy to talk.
A lot of these, they probably, like my father-in-law actually grew up on Fernandina and he talks about when you could just go into the fort wasn't a park. It was just there. You could go in there. They would find artifacts and, you know, I mean, of course, this is my father-in-law. He's telling me I'm finding arrowheads and this and that, you know, who knows? But it was just like kids that lived on the island would just go up there and ride their bikes and climb around and have totally free access to the place. You know, now when you get there, you pull up to that front gate and you think, okay, I'm entering the park. It's like another couple miles through the park, and then like, I think it's like 3 to the campground. Great place to camp. And great beaches there. The fort is amazing. And I agree. I think it is kind of like, it's neat. It reminds me a lot of Fort DeSoto in the way that you have this really rather large park in a place that otherwise would have been built out by Florida real estate.
Absolutely. I mean, that's prime real estate.
Yeah. Like I know like Molino State Park and some of these state parks up there that the CCC was involved with. The eye was on turning these into national parks. You know, they didn't know, you know, whether or not the national park system would take interest in these properties. So there was kind of halfway an eye towards turning them into national parks. I think it was probably a lofty expectation given what we know of what does get chosen to be a national park and that they are kind of few and far between. But that's the care that went into them.
Well, that was the model they used. The state had actually mandated that we have a state park system, but it was mandated in the 20s and it was the bottom fell out of the land boom. So they had nothing. So when the CCC came in, the only model they had, there was no existing state park model. Like, well, we're just going to make them look like national parks, we guess. You know, it would be great.
Yeah. We'd like to ruin Florida in general. The state parks in Florida, they are fantastic. Like I'm never disappointed when I visit a state park in Florida. They're always in, and this is comparing them to other state parks in other states where they're allowed to fall into disrepair sometimes. Like that is not the case in Florida. I feel like, you know, you can roll into any state park in Florida and probably have excellent facilities, probably a good historical exhibit where it exists. And I think they do a fantastic job.
They should be, I mean, I would love to sit down my next book when I finish this one. I would love to sit down and do a narrative about just spending a year camping in Florida state parks because it's,
For booking a state park campsite in Florida.
Well, I think that's going to calm down I'm already seeing campers for sale. I think everybody now, the world's opening back up and I think it's going to calm down a little because people bought campers thinking it was going to be one way and then they realized you have to do things to them. But the state parks are amazing. And what's nice about them is that I don't think there's a lot of them you can get to right off the interstate, right? So it's not, it requires a little bit of backroads travel to get to most of them, or at least travel through, you know, like, I guess the Correction State Park is off, I think, 41 or something like that. So is, what's the one with the walking dredge in?
Collier Seminole.
Yeah, Collier Seminole. That's off 41. Yeah, but even those roads, getting to them, you get to go by some great stuff on the roads. And that's part of the fun of traveling.
The roads, like when you go to Fernandina, like coming from the south, you know, we always go up 301. And you kind of like, you catch 301 somewhere around Ocala and just keep going. And don't even get on I-10. Don't get on 95. Just kind of cut up through, I think, I forget the name of the town that's up there. Is it Baldwin, maybe?
There's Baldwin, Lottie, Waldo.
I'm talking even for like north of I-10, there's a town up there. I forget what it's called that you go through and then you catch like whatever 200 that runs right into Amelia. These are great roads because they're never traffic. Now, once you hit Yulee, before you get to Amelia Island, before you go over the bridge, Yulee is where everybody that used to live on Amelia Island and then they sold their properties for a mint moved. And that's where all your Targets and Walmarts and everything is. And it's like a giant long stretch of retail. But before you get all there, you know, you have like this 301 is kind of like this wonderful 4-lane non-interstate highway.
Yes. And you are thinking of Baldwin, by the way.
Yeah. Am I? Okay. Yes. So I encourage you, wherever you are on this stretch of road, stop at the guy selling boiled peanuts, because a lot of people, you get down south here in Florida, you talk about boiled peanuts and people aren't buying them. And people haven't but tried them.
And I think you're just going to gas stations that are too nice if you're not.
That's true. You got to go. You have to go into the. But the thing is, people don't go into gas stations anymore because you pay at the pump, right?
Well, but I think you have a little unusual situation in that your very young son is something of a boiled peanut aficionado.
Yes, yes, yes. I did just kind of slip that in there. But yeah, our son tasted boiled peanuts first time in Gulfport, Florida, at the little Town Shores Market. Yep. Used to sell them there. And they're usually in a crock pot in the gas station, unless it's like a nice fancy gas station like a Wawa or something. Don't go in there if you're looking for boiled peanuts. But you can also get them on the side of the road up there. There's a place, I want to say it's between the plantation and the town proper, like on the side of the road. I remember specifically, and there's several signs. You got to stop there, get yourself a big thing of boiled peanuts. It's a boiled peanut, listeners that are up north. You take a raw peanut or an unroasted peanut if the raw peanuts aren't in season, and you boil them and you boil them and you boil them forever. You boil them like you would in a crock pot, like all day, 8 hours or something, with a ton of salt. So like if I fill my crock pot up with peanuts, I'm going to pour like a half a cup of salt in there and just let them go. And by nighttime, they're soft. You open them up, they're full of that salty, briny water. And the peanuts,
you can put hot sauce in them too.
You can put, yeah, a lot of people do Cajun. Our son doesn't do Cajun. But not only is it a delicious, unlike many Southern delicacies, which will take a good food and make it better using all kinds of things that aren't healthy for us. You know, salt is not necessarily like a vitamin or something, but the boiled peanut is the healthiest way to eat a peanut.
Tell me more about this, because I'm having a hard time with that.
As a parent, I was concerned that our son was consuming, half a pound of boiled peanuts every morning for breakfast. So I thought, a can of boiled peanuts, can and a half, depends on if they're measured off. So, but yeah, like a bowl full of boiled peanuts. What is that, a quarter of a pound? I don't weigh them. A serving, probably four servings. Anyway, so I Googled this. First of all, I actually asked first. We have a friend up in Cleveland who's a well-known pediatrician. He edits the Dr. Spock baby book because Dr. Spock passed away. So yes. Robert Needleman edits the Dr. Spock baby book. And we said, is it okay for him to eat these boiled peanuts? And he was like, unless he's like, shouldn't eat salt, like, he's got hypertension or something, or, some condition that says, your body's reacting to salt, it's okay. It's really hard to eat too much salt, right? And
really?
So he said, that's okay. And I was kind of like, he was being, I took his word for it, but then I had to Google it. And researchers at one of the universities now, I think it was Alabama, Birmingham, did a study on the boiled peanut. And the boiled peanut retains its antioxidants, its cancer-fighting agents, and its vitamins better because they're boiled in water and cooked in the skin. Whereas when we roast them, we're removing a lot of those properties. They retains it four times as much as other preparations of the peanut. Typically we roast them. The boiled peanut is healthier. And when you consider, the garbage that people call breakfast these days, something that is so loaded in protein and fiber and antioxidants.
Is this podcast sponsored by the Boiled Peanut Commission?
It is not, but Peanut Patch, if you want to reach out, I've been trolling you. We go through a lot of boiled peanuts in this house. Like I buy them in the restaurant size cans, or I'll buy huge bags of them and do them myself in the Instant Pot. That's my new method, is the Instant Pot. Shaves a couple hours off of it. But they are delicious, I'm telling you. So when you're driving on one of these country roads and you see boiled peanuts for sale, don't go, I'm afraid to stop there. That's going to be weird. I don't know how to eat them. Go buy them. They come in they usually give you a bag or a styrofoam cup, and you just don't eat the shell. But I've seen people try and eat the shell because they're softer than a regular peanut. Don't eat the shell.
You kind of
suck the juice out. You open it. You kind of suck the juice out. And then you open it up and the peanut is soft, almost like a bean, not as soft as a bean, but soft, you know, as a bean that's been cooked. And they're delicious. They're fantastic. And they're good for you. Better than a lot of the junk food out there. So.
Okay. Well, just they're not junk food.
Go to Familia Island, Fernandina, there, and stop at one of the roadside stands or a gas station. The ones in the gas station are good. In fact, the study in Alabama found that the canned boiled peanuts actually were actually a little bit healthier than the roadside stand ones, for whatever reason. And I could give you a whole thing on the civil rights history of the boiled peanut if you want, but that might be for another episode.
I mean, I we've gone into a very peanutty area here.
Yes.
That I didn't expect to go, but I will make sure that we reach out. John mentioned Peanut Patch. Listeners who are not as aggressively pursuing the boiled peanut probably don't realize that most of the cans of boiled peanuts that you can get at grocery stores and also that they use to make the boiled peanuts at the gas stations comes from a company called the Peanut Patch.
Yes.
So I actually follow them on Twitter. I too am a boiled peanut fan.
I follow them on Instagram. We've actually been reposted on their Instagram. But when I reached out to try and get a pallet of boiled peanuts, they told me to be a store, which I am not yet.
So you couldn't buy a pallet of peanuts?
I don't really have a loading dock at my house. So I could probably go to Walmart and buy a pallet of them off of Walmart. That's what I need to do. You can also get good boiled peanuts, not Peanut Patch, but boiled peanuts at GFS. They sell them in the freezer. They're good.
Gordon Food Services. Yeah. Okay. Well,
we do an episode, one thing, you know, I should mention also, but going back to Amelia Island, is it also is the home of American Beach.
Should be its own podcast.
Yeah. So we should talk about American Beach and boiled peanuts and their history in the civil rights movement on another episode. Because American Beach, since we're not going to talk about it, American Beach was a black beach. When beaches were segregated, it was a black beach that was developed by black entrepreneurs. And there was the subject of a movie called Sunshine State, although it was sort of veiled in the movie. And it's right there on that stretch around the Amelia Island plantation area.
I think that's actually probably a whole other podcast, and I agree we should do that. But
yeah.
probably not today. We've talked about the War of Jenkins' Ear, Fort Clinch, why you should stop for boiled peanuts. What else is there to say other than if you're listening and there's something about Florida you want to know or someplace you're planning a trip and you want us to cover it in a future podcast, please reach out to us. I mean, just let us know and we'll be happy to do it. We love to get email. We'll put a link in the show notes so you can find it, but you can always send me an email at kathycelestri@gmail.com. Don't know how to spell it. You do have to go to the show notes. I'm not going to,
not going to spell it for you.
It's a long name. Definitely reach out to us because we love to talk about all parts of Florida. And if you're not a boiled peanut person, we can definitely tell you what other food you should stop and eat in Florida along the road.
Yeah.
So, but I think that's pretty much, we agreed. That's our motto on a road trip. Just always stop. You never regret.
Stop. Yeah.
You never regret stopping, but you will regret not stopping. I still regret to this day, the day we were driving into the Everglades on 41 on the Tamiami Trail. And there was a couple sitting on some very nice cast off dining room chairs, like the 1980s type with the peach upholstered backs and stuff, you know, with the white frame. And they were holding, one of them was holding a teenage gator. And there was a sign saying, come inside and hug and pet a gator. And I didn't
stop. Teenage gator?
Yeah. So it wasn't like a hatchling. It was probably about 3 feet long. 3 to 4 feet long.
But it wasn't like 13 years old.
No. I mean, in gator years. So yeah, it's a teenager. Okay. So,
what are gator years?
I don't know.
They're like dog years of seven, you know?
No, I think gators live longer. Gators live, they'd say 40 years on average. So teenage gator, I mean, he was probably, I don't know, six. I don't know. I don't know how they grow. Gators freak me out a little bit. But I regret not stopping. And I've never seen them there since. We drive it at least once a year, and I've never seen them since. So you always stop. You never know what you're going to find.
Yep. Driving, or turn around. Turn around. You can
turn
around.
It's not always easy
to turn around.
You're pulling a camper. I mean,
yeah, we're in a 25-foot RV. There have been times I'm like, okay, I have to make a 3-point turn on this 2-lane road because I got to go see what that was.
I'm just going to stop traffic and just they can all wait. So. All right, folks, thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed learning about Fernandina and Amelia Island and boiled peanuts today. I've been one of your hosts, Kathy Celestri, along with, of course, John Kyle. And we'll see you next time on the Florida Spectacular.